You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 2nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Hacker, Professor Emeritus of Poli-Science, the Queen City CUNY Colleges, author of The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions. Also on the program today, couldn't be more excited, Barack Obama comes out for expanding Social Security. I mean, literally, I thought about just canceling the entire program today and doing nothing but that.
The thing is that as soon as I saw that pop up on Twitter, you were the first person that I thought of, and I was just imagining that that was happiest you've been since Scalia died.
Yes, exactly. We'll talk more about that as the show continues, I promise. Obamacare's ups and downs come into focus. TPP supporters white-knuckled, hoping to pass it during the lame duck session, but it won't be easy. Bernie Sanders lets it known the DNC vetoed a union pick for the platform committee. Meanwhile, the Clinton IT aide will plead the Fifth Amendment in a lawsuit brought by a right-wing organization. That same IT guy still cooperating with the FBI investigation. Paul Ryan performs his own Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And Donald Trump causes the head of Hispanic media relations at the RNC to quit. Yes.
Surprise, surprise.
Meanwhile, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau limits payday loans are out, and the State Department admits to doctoring a video. All that and more on today's program. Folks, a little bit of house cleaning to do. This program is not nominated for Best News in Politics at podcastawards.com because we won too many times, literally. We've been given a legacy
award. They got sick of it.
What are you going to do?
I mean, it's true.
It's right. We won so much, they got sick of us. However, the Ring of Fire podcast has been nominated, and you can vote for it every day. In fact, you must vote for it every day at podcastawards.com. There's some right-wing shows in there. You don't want to lose to them. Go to podcastawards.com, vote for Ring of Fire. You have to put your email address in and verify it. Check to see that you got to verify the email address after you vote. But please, every day, vote for that if you could. We got a tremendous response yesterday for our in the fun half. Did we do the whole thing in the fun half? We did a little bit in the free show, right? The libertarian debate coverage. And I have to say, look, I certainly am not the type of person not to take credit for things. But it's really, we owe it all to the libertarians who actually debated. Because what they did in and of itself was so hilarious and entertaining that we were just basically sitting back. We were almost like an audience itself, right? We were in awe of their performance. We did want to give you a, in honor of President Obama, and we're going to talk more about this Obama statement of expansion of Social Security, because remember, this is a long haul. I mean, he entered in the transition team in January of 2009, pre-inauguration, he was talking about so-called entitlement reform. This has been a long, strange trip. But in honor of that, let's hear what Libertarian presidential candidate Daryl Perry had to say in responding to a question of how to pay for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And this is what he had to say.
Mr. Perry. As with everything, I believe they should be completely voluntary. How many people in here, and I actually do want a show of hands, love grandmas? How many of you would donate money to feed grandmas? I do not see a single person that did not raise their hand. That's how you fund Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare.
So voluntary donations, and if you run short, I guess they didn't love grandma enough.
We got specific on the grandma, you know? I like some grandmas.
Right.
Other grandmas, eh.
I mean, this is pretty stunning that this is actually, like, passed off as some form of policy. I mean, the answer to this question, that the honest answer is, if people want to give to their grandmas, they can give to their grandmas. But we as a society have no responsibility to care for the elderly. In fact, it worked out so well pre-Social Security that only 2/3 of seniors were living in poverty. And of course, that was a time where, you know, people tended to live a little bit less. So even then, of course, the other alternate answer would have been to give grandma a jetpack.
Why are we even talking about Social Security? We could have jetpacks. Grandma could have blood transfusions from spaceships.
Indeed.
We didn't have the government, man.
Indeed. Want to take a moment to introduce you to today's sponsor, libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org is the premier resource for learning about the theories, principles, and history of free societies. Their site has podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Libertarianism.org is great for those of you who are skeptical that there's one way of doing things. In their words, why not err on the side of more freedom? Some respect for what makes us all different. Learn more about the idea of using a little more liberty at libertarianism.org. I hope we don't have to re-record that, because you were laughing so much during that, Michael. I mean, look, I think people should go over there and check it out. Yeah. I mean, video.
Turn away. Turn
I'm
away.
I'm working my best.
You should explore all your options.
You should explore all your options.
And
what are you
going to
do?
Is
hovercraft or jetpack?
I definitely agree with the fact that there is a lot of human diversity in thinking. There's a lot of different ways of doing things.
You should definitely explore all options that have one of our codes on it. Majority FM or Majority Reporters, whatever. What's the code?
Well, there is no code. You just had
I was about
to
say smooth transition there, until it was not.
But I will say this. You know, there are some things we have sponsors of the program. There are some, I have actually been over to libertarianism.org. I checked it out. It's true. There are videos there. I will say, that I'm going to get myself in trouble more, but you know, let me tell you this. Look, here's what you do. You head over there and you sleep on it. You watch it, you sleep on it. Now, here's how you should sleep on it. The Casper mattress is engineered by a team of in-house engineers. They spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foam for a sleep surface that's got just the right amount of sink, just the right amount of bounce. Now, I think you, if you've ever bought a mattress, and I think most of you probably have, you will not be surprised. Well, let me put it this way. the Casper is not only obsessively engineered, but it's also done so at a shockingly fair price. Mattresses can cost over $1,500, right? At Casper, a mattress costs $500 for a twin size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, $950 for a king. Those are incredibly reasonable prices. However, that's not even the best thing about it. It's an award-winning sleep surface. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. It's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. And here's the part that I love about it. They ship it directly to your door for free. They will return it. You can return it to them for free within the U.S. and Canada. And you can try Casper for 100 nights. 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. And on top of that, made in America. I told you what the prices were. Guess what? Take $50 off. $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/majority and using the code majority. Terms and conditions apply. casper.com/majority. Use the code majority. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. I really want to get to the Obama stuff, but we will get to that. Okay, we got another minute here. Here is President Obama at a high school in Elkhart, Indiana. Remember, in January of 2009, he was talking about entitlement reform. In 2012, during the debt ceiling crisis, he offered cuts to Social Security to the Republicans. In his 2013 budget, he called for a chain CPI, which is another way of saying we're going to recalculate benefits and we're going to give you cuts to Social Security. There were two reasons why we got to this day. Reason number one is the Republicans would not take yes for an answer and make the deal that he wanted to make. And reason number two is because progressive groups, progressive writers, progressive bloggers, you people fought tooth and nail, not just to avoid cuts, but to expand Social Security. We already have on the books a resolution, non-binding, they're in the minority, of the entire Democratic caucus, like maybe minus one, not even sure about that, voting in favor of expanding Social Security. One of two of our presidential candidates has talked about expanding Social Security broadly, and the other one has talked about it expanding Social Security in a more targeted fashion. President Obama yesterday at this school essentially, if anything, made the presumptive, or not maybe quite presumptive, but the leading candidate in the Democratic primary almost a half a step outside of mainstream Democratic thought by coming out with this. It's clip number two.
But look, let's face it, a lot of Americans don't have retirement savings. Even if they've got an account set up, they just don't have enough money at the end of the month to save as much as they'd like because they're just barely paying the bills. Fewer and fewer people have pensions they can really count on, which is why Social Security is more important than ever. We can't afford to weaken Social Security. We should be strengthening Social Security. And not only do we need to strengthen its long-term health, it's time we finally made Social Security more generous and increased its benefits so that today's retirees and future generations get the dignified retirement that they've earned. And we could start paying for it by asking the wealthiest Americans to contribute a little bit more. They can afford it. I can afford it.
Now, the raising the cap, that's not new with President Obama. He said that in 2007 as a candidate. But he was saying it in the context of what he said in this speech as strengthening Social Security. More generous benefits, that's new. That's big, ladies and gentlemen. That's big. because it basically sets the marker. And his entire equation there, where he talks about how 401ks have failed, that people don't have money in their pensions. Google Duncan Black, otherwise known as Atrios, USA Today, and you will find at least one or two editorials written 2 or 3 years ago when it was like considered fantasy land that the Democrats would even adopt this position. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal. It is a perfect example of incrementalism working incrementally. We're not there yet, but it's exciting. Folks, Father's Day is coming up. Now, I'm very fortunate because I already have Harrys.com razors. I have been using them for, I guess, a couple of years. Holy cow. I'm getting old. And but it just occurred to me, literally, as reading this ad, that I'm going to get my dad a Harry's shaver. I mean, because not only do I love Harrys.com as a razor, but it's also not only very high quality, also not terribly expensive. And as I know that my dad does not listen to the show, he is not going to realize that I'm going to get a great deal on a Harrys.com razor. There is a Harry's shave set, okay? This is both a personal but also a practical gift. I don't want to give him another thing that he's just going to shove into a drawer, forget that I gave him, claim I didn't give him a present, and then get mad at me about it. The limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, 3 of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover, all for $40. Plus, it comes in a sleek, giftable box with the option to add custom engraving and a personalized card. The other great thing about it is I can actually send him Harry's razor blades throughout the year to remind him that I gave him a gift, and he'll think that I'm spending a ton, but I'm not. Harry's also offers shaving sets at different price points, starting at, yes, $15. You get one for yourself. It's a great shave at a fair price. 5 German-crafted blades, flex hinge, lubricating strip, quality guaranteed, full refund if you're not happy. Order online. You avoid the hassle of going to that store to pick up a gift. Plus, shipping to the U.S. is free for all Harry's shave sets. Go to Harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MajorityReport. Don't wait. Free shipping for Father's Day ends on Friday, June 3rd, so act now. That's Harry's, Harrys.com. Enter the code MajorityReport. You got to spell it out. MajorityReport. At the checkout, you get $5 off. Get Dad something he'll actually use this Father's Day. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Andrew Hacker. Here I dreamt I was a soldier, and I marched the streets of Birkenau. And I recall in spring the perfume that the air would bring to the indolent town. And I am nothing of a builder. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Andrew Hacker. He is a political science professor at Queens City College, City University of New York, author of The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Well, it's great to be with you, Sam.
So, all right, let me start with this. What was it, and I mean, I have a sense of it, but what was it that got you thinking about the problem, or I guess the question, the issue with teaching math to American students?
Okay, it's a fair question. Okay, as you mentioned, I'm a political scientist, and people like myself look at policies, health policy, military policy, you know, just to judge how well we're doing things. And I found myself turning to education because I discovered that there was this huge math requirement that we impose on every single young American. And I begin to wonder, why are we doing this? Because the fallout is really great. One of the consequences is that we have one of the highest proportion of high school dropouts. And the single biggest academic reason is all that math they have to take.
So this problem of dropping out, and you also talk about it in the context of community colleges as well as high schools. Your book has been, and really starting with a piece that you wrote, I think it was back in 2012 on algebra, has been really controversial. And I know we're going to take some grief from some mathematicians out there as we go forward. But what do you say to the more general response of like, well, just because math is hard and it drives people out of high school at a fairly consistent rate and maybe community colleges, why would we want to get rid of it? I mean, that's why make things easier?
Well, if all we can say in favor of all that math is it's hard, we could, if you just like hard for its own sake, how about push-ups? How about T.S. Eliot's poetry? How about reading Virgil in the original Latin? There are all sorts of ways to instill rigorous habits of mind in students. Algebra is not the only way. You can do this through poetry. You can do this through studying history. I'm not in favor of dumbing down. I'm just asking how much math is too much.
Well, I mean, where did this come from? Because, you know, it strikes me that the reason why I wanted to have you on is because I found math, I ran into a problem with my math teacher in high school, and it was, I got completely turned off from math. I mean, I was a difficult student, too, so I don't put it all on him. But it seems to me that there is this sort of attitude of like, I sort of was drawing an analogy between austerity as a policy and math. It just sort of seems to be like one of these things where there's sort of like there's some type of morality around the idea that if like you were to get rid of math, it would be, or I guess you're not saying get rid of it, but if you were to change it or in some way make it not a requirement, that it's sort of like there's something immoral about it in some way.
Absolutely immoral. And that's because for so many people who are so, you know, attached to mathematics, it has become a religion. And they want to have everybody worship at their church, the full liturgy, start going all the way from geometry up to calculus. They've gone through it. They like it. They love it. They're attached to it. That's okay, but why make everybody else do it? And the rest of us find it difficult to reply because we're so awed by mathematics. It's we fear it, we revere it, we look at all those symbols on the board, all those trinomials, and we say, gee, they must know something that we don't know. Well, the answer is, of course they do, but this doesn't mean that all of us have to master it.
Now, I've read some criticism of your your perspective on algebra, that you that the idea that you have that we're teaching, really, I guess the criticism that I've read has been that, well, you're right to a certain extent about where we should land, but you have diagnosed the problem wrong. The problem is not so much that we shouldn't be studying algebra, it's that we're studying the wrong algebra, right? That we're not studying the algebra that was first developed in the 800s by Al-Khwarizmi, I think it is.
Right.
But that rather we're studying the algebra that was refined by the French in the 16th century, and we should get back to the original algebra. What do you make of that type of critique?
Well, that's an intramural discussion among mathematicians. What's the best way to teach their own subject? What I would say is I'd like to have alternatives, other options. For example, in my book, the final chapter, I outline a class that I taught at my own college that I call Numeracy 101, which doesn't require any algebra or geometry. It's simply what I'd call serious arithmetic, adult arithmetic, using numbers, percentages, ratios. And I give about 12 of the assignments I used in the class, everything on from politics to the consumer price index to a variety of issues, let's say comparing standard of living in two countries. Now, you can do all of that without academic algebra, without academic math. You can do it with the arithmetic that we learned all the way up through fifth grade.
Well, I mean, give us an example of one of those type of scenarios so that we get a sense of it.
Okay. I take two countries which have the same standard of living in terms of gross domestic product per person, the United States and Norway. And I say, let's compare these two advanced democratic countries. We look and we discover the United States has 10 times more people in prison than Norway. Or we discover that the distribution of income is much more severe in the United States, much more egalitarian in Norway. We look at ethnic variation in two countries. We look at obesity rates. And by using numbers, just using numbers and rates, you begin to get a good impression of, let's say, two countries, rather than just, talking about words. One's fair, the other's unfair. Let's look at the numbers. And that's what I do in the class. I want students to become as numerically agile as they are with language.
Can you like broadly speaking, or maybe even more specifically, tell us what the difference between these things are? Because I think, for those of us who got intimidated by math in high school and then sort of just, did a tactical retreat in some way and just, then got turned off by, I'm not even sure that I can sort of really articulate what the difference between that familiarity with numbers that you're talking about or deep adult arithmetic and, algebra, geometry, I have a sense, but trigonometry, I never got there. Calculus, I had abandoned ship way before then. But I mean, tell us sort of like, but broadly speaking, like what the difference is between those things.
Okay, absolutely. And by the way, Sam, your experience with trigonometry and all the rest is the same for about 90% of Americans. 90% will echo what you're saying. They wonder, why did I have to take it? And does it apply to what I do today? Well, there's a friend of mine who teaches physics at Columbia University, which is a highly selective school. And he had in his class students who had scored between 700 and 800 on the math SAT, real math wizards. But he discovered they couldn't do simple quantitative problems. He gave them a little quantitative test in reading graphs, statistics, and they all failed it. There's a real myth that studying math helps you with numbers. Now, and it doesn't. So, for example, if you want to study a corporate report or the federal budget or compare campaign promises on cutting taxes and what revenues will be, math doesn't help you. What you need is a separate sharpening of your arithmetic skills. And what we do is we stop teaching arithmetic about the sixth grade, and we shove kids into algebra and geometry. What I'm in favor of is more options where you do advanced arithmetic. Now, I know that sounds silly, arithmetic. Hey, that's just 2 plus 2. But it's not. It's ratios, it's comparing, it's correlations, it's all sorts of fascinating and useful stuff.
And so, that has been one of my biggest laments, is that I don't have an idea of even how to read a ledger, frankly. And I think much to the concern of the people who work here at this podcast, one day I'll just come in and say, I guess I have no way of paying anybody or something to that effect. So how did this, give me a sense of how you think this became so prominent. I mean, you use this example of it being like a religion, and on some level there's always this quality to having a field of study difficult to permeate in some ways that it becomes rarefied. But how was it in the context of our educational system? Did this become so much of a religion? And B, is there an analog in other, I guess, Western countries in terms of math being this prominent, or are there examples of what you are advocating?
Okay, good enough. First of all, part of it is obviously intellectual inertia. It's always been there. We have over 200,000 people who teach math in high school and colleges who kind of have, I must say, an intellectual vested interest in what they know, and they want to keep teaching it. But something else has happened, and there is the subtitle of my book, what I call STEM delusions. STEM, as we all know, is science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And now we're suddenly being told that the United States is falling behind other countries in STEM skills. They're moving ahead of us. We're going to lose the global competition. This, Sam, is a total myth. We do not need more people with STEM degrees. In fact, most of the people who majored in STEM subjects at college are not working in STEM fields. We don't create that many jobs in STEM. And what we do need is really creativity. Take something like Google or Apple's products or Twitter. That's not just technology. There's an imagination, a playfulness about how we'll use our minds and going across. So I think we need just as many design, artistic, liberal arts graduates as we do STEM graduates.
What do you think contributing to this? I mean, my sense is on some level, you know, we have the ascendance of the engineer in some respect. I don't know if it's because of, like, I don't know, Bill Gates is just funding everybody. And so we all sort of agree with that. I mean, is that a part of that? I mean, because to a certain extent, we've seen liberal arts degrees have become, you know, almost ascendant now in that tech world. But at the same time, I don't know. I mean, give me, elaborate on that idea that where does this STEM delusion come from?
Okay, the STEM delusion comes from that out there are super smart Koreans and Chinese who are mastering mathematics and they're going to rule the world. Now, in fact, by the way, the reason why the Chinese and the Koreans do as well as they do in various, say, international math competitions is they study 23 hours a day. And if the competitions were in, let's say, chess or crossword puzzles, they'd study 23 hours a day and master them as well. Now, what we'd simply say is that in the United States, we don't have as many people willing to work 23 hours a day, at least not at the technical subjects. But they are very good. Take, for example, video games. Video games are not just high tech. You have to do the plot, you have to do the costumes, the music, the artwork, the acting. All of that's what makes for a good video game. I've learned in the video industry, 3/4 of the people are not tech people.
Right. And so what happens next? How does something, a reform like this, gain any steam?
Well, part of it comes down to a word you used earlier, rigor. There's the notion that Americans are growing soft and flabby, and we have to have more rigor. This is kind of the old Puritan idea, and in many ways I'm a teacher. I agree in, the rigorous use of the mind. And then somehow we get the notion that it's only math and science that's true rigor, and that is really shooting ourselves in the foot. Because what is, the interesting kind of rigor is inventing something like McDonald's or Starbucks. I know there's a bit of high tech in Starbucks coffee, but the whole idea of Starbucks, and McDonald's sweeping the world, is, unfettered imagination, a playfulness about what to do. And I find this whole STEM thing with its rigor, you can't be playful anymore.
There's also, it seems to me, to be some type of paradox, and maybe it's just, a misunderstanding on my part of what constitutes sort of math and where something like this. But we're living in an age which seems to me to be as data-oriented as any that we've had ever. And I don't think that's just a function of having computers. I mean, I think there's a disposition towards data and maximization of optimization of everything in some respects.
Let me go on with data here. I'm all in favor of data and a sensible adult way of looking at it. For example, one of the assignments I gave to students in my numeracy class was to give them a government document called DEATHS, D-E-A-T-H-S, rather somber, all the causes why people died in the last year. And it's a big book, almost 100 pages, filled with hundreds, thousands of numbers. And I said, let's see what we can find out. Well, one of the things we looked at is causes of death for young people, age 15 to 25, young men, 15 to 25 causes of death. Then we broke it down by race. And guess what we discovered? You had to look at the numbers, it's data, very carefully. Among young white men, the chief cause of death was automobile accidents. Among the black men, the chief cause of death was being shot by a gun.
Hmm.
Now that tells us about two Americas, two ways of death. And you're dead at the end of both, but look what happens. And imagine the discussion you can get started once you get those numbers in front of you. So numbers tell a story. I'm in favor of numbers.
How does this break through? I mean, where are the where are the, in terms of reform, and maybe this is sort of outside of your portfolio, but putting your policy hat back on, where would you start? Is this something where it has to be accepted by the Department of Education needs to come to this realization first? Is this something that you perceive could come out of the states? Where is the entree in our educational system to sort of introduce this idea?
Okay, good enough. I just say that when I propose to my mathematician friends that they do something like my studying of death certificates, they say, oh yes, we'll do statistics, but you need to study algebra first. And I say, no, a simple abacus will do. But let's go back to your question of where you start. I have in front of me a list of over 100 really good colleges that do not require the SAT. There are colleges like Pfizer out in the West Coast, Colorado College in, Colorado,
mm-hmm.
Bates, Bowdoin, and so on, they don't require the SAT. In particular, they don't require the math section in it. They're willing to admit the students without those, you know, terrifying math scores. And they discovered that students without the SAT do just as well as the other students. So what I want to do is to persuade more and more colleges, and through them the high schools, that you don't have to have a full four-year mathematical sequence for everybody. After the first or second year, introduce options, like, as I said, my Numeracy 101. And I've discovered that liberal arts colleges, which are pulling away from the SAT, are willing to talk about that. Yes, and I like that idea.
Yeah, I mean, don't you have a concern that potentially, you know, when you start with things, institutions like higher education, or in particularly sort of private colleges, that you may be leaving behind a lot of people. I mean, isn't that one of the criticisms, is that this, in some ways, to diminish the role of math in some ways is creates a sort of class, puts people of lower income at a disadvantage because they won't be able to access this stuff, or it sends it. I mean, I guess it gets back to the rigor question, but I know that there's been some criticism of this idea that it, in some ways, it will shut the door to women in these fields and to people coming from lower income.
I think it's just the opposite. What's happened is, because we have one size fits all with mathematics, for example, that is the case in the Common Core. The Common Core, which, as we all know, is going to be introduced really full steam next year in over 40 states, the Common Core is a single test for everyone. Male, female, rich, poor, math-oriented, math-suicidal. And they call it college or career ready, but it really means college ready. In other words, the math people are imposing a college-type curriculum on everybody. Now, should everybody go to college? In fact, as a college teacher, I think so. But for all sorts of things, you can study modern dance, you can study poetry, you can study design. You don't have to do, everybody doesn't have to be expert in STEM subjects. And I would say, on the class question, that just as many people from the suburbs, you know, turn, to use my phrase, suicidal over geometry, as do from other social classes. It's not a class thing at all.
Andrew Hacker, author of The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions. I wish I could take your class in numeracy. I feel like I desperately need it. And but so if that ever goes online, please let us know. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking with you, Sam.
All right, folks. Bates
leading the way.
Not a very rigorous school.
But it's ranked higher than Connecticut College, though.
Well,
so that's,
I mean,
a
that's
shame.
The thing. You get caught up in those type of numbers. Maybe you need to take a numeracy class to figure out what.
Why I'm ranked
what?
Ahead of you?
What? Excuse me.
In terms of a college perspective, take a numeracy class to figure out why Bates is above Connecticut College.
Well, I mean, you're comparing apples and oranges, okay? Because if you went back to when I graduated, you would find that that school not as rigorous as the school I attended.
I don't even know which school you're talking about now. Which school wasn't as rigorous?
Your school, not as rigorous as my school.
Okay.
That's all right. What we're...
I feel like I'm in a libertarian
debate. See, I think this
now.
Is what... Yeah, exactly.
My school had jetpacks.
Well, that may be the case, Michael. But let me just thank you again to our sponsor, libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org has hundreds of informative resources to learn about the theories, history, and principles of free societies. There are podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Learn more about free and open societies at libertarianism.org. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will... probably just keep talking about Social Security, even though we've covered it, and take calls from libertarians. If there's any libertarians out there, and if there's not, why not head over to libertarianism.org, study up, call it, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. In the fun half, we will hear about Michael's investigation into where Bates ranks at Connecticut College. I see him furiously Googling.
Oh, no, it's still ahead.
Mm.
Oh, didn't take that long.
What's your source?
U.S. News and World Report.
No, seriously?
Well, that is the ranking source. But you have some type of like special,
you have the page
like,
open, Michael?
Yeah, what's some
the
type of Cedar
People,
system?
People Magazine didn't come up with a ranking either? I mean, give me a break.
You have the page People open? Magazine? He doesn't.
What's
People
that?
Because I'm looking for it, too.
People Magazine does a college ranking system?
I'm just saying. Big diff. I mean, U.S.
Hey,
News.
Hey, look, I'm sorry.
Who,
I don't mean
who
to.
Who owns U.S. News World Report?
The Bates College Trustee Forum.
That's right. Oh, my God. All right, 646-257-3920. You can IM us. Don't forget, it's your membership that makes this show possible. Join the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day to support this program. I can tell you that, well, I mean, I guess now we do take money from the Cato Institute. So besides the Cato Institute, we take no institutional support. Jesus. We'll see you in the fun app.